Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Barb Pavlyukova, as was introduced, and there it is. And I will be presenting to you on the past and future perspectives on voluntary certification in public health, and talk a little bit about the perceptions and motivations of why people have gone and taken certification in public health. And I also have no relationships to disclose prior to beginning. The exam data that I'm going to be looking at is from an end-of-exam survey that that CPH examinees take after they complete the exam. So I cover all 4 years that the exam has been offered so far, so 2008, 2009, 10, and 11. And of course, there's the difference between 2008 and 9 exams, where it was just alumni of accredited programs, and 2010 and 11, when it was opened up to students as well. As you just heard. And those are the numbers of how many examinees took the post-test survey. And that actually ends up to be most of the examinees, I think it's somewhere around 95%. So it's a very good response rate and relatively, I guess, it's a good basis of all the CPH examinees. And I've not taken the certification of public health exam. I've only seen the post-exam data. I haven't seen any of the articles of the exam, so I have no insider tips on how to pass it in February. So what were motivations to take the exam? If you look at 2008 and 2009, the motivations included increasing credibility as a public health professional, and that ranked above 70%, 73% in 2009 and 76% in 2008. And second on that list was increasing the credibility of the public health profession. In 2010 and 11, the question changed a little bit to primary motivation, and you can see that about 50% of examinees responded that they had taken the exam to increase their credibility as a public health professional. You can also notice that increasing salary earning potential is not a major motivation for public health examinees, which makes sense since I think few of us actually go into public health for the money, more to do good. As far as how they were encouraged to take the public health exam, public health degree programs in 2008 and 9, respondents said that they were neither encouraged nor discouraged. That's about 58% in 2008 and 46% in 2009 responded that. Although nobody was discouraged, which was good, or very few people were, somewhere around 5%. And in 2010 and 11, and this might be a shift due to the changing demographic of the population of being opened up to students and about half of the examinees being students, it looks like most 40.2% in 2010 and 45.8% were very much encouraged by their public health degree programs to take the exam, which is quite encouraging for the exam itself. As far as employers encouraging participants, so about 75 to 80% in 2008 and 9 were neither encouraged nor discouraged to take the exam. And 2010 and 11, which is when students were taking it, which accounts for a lot of the no answers for unemployed students, not at all was the response for about 1/3 of all the examinees. So it shows kind of not many employers are encouraging. However, there are a lot of employers that have begun to encourage their employees to take the CPH, and hopefully there'll be more joining their ranks soon. One of the ways that organizations and schools have been encouraging employees and their students to take the exam is by subsidizing the registration fees. So in 2010 and 11, it was asked whether exams were subsidized, and approximately half in 46% in 2010 and 48% in 2011 had some of their exam fees subsidized by another party, whether it was a school or an employer. And regarding what percentage of the registration fee that they were personally responsible for paying, in 2010 there's about 1/4 of the respondents did not have to pay anything, so 0%. And in 2011, 0% wasn't an answer, but if you can see that the other category is hovering at 28.2%, and if you look through that, the majority of those answers were zero or none type of responses. And the University of Pittsburgh actually this year is subsidizing me to go, so that's one of the reasons that has motivated me to do it, in addition to improving my credibility as a public health professional. So the fee is about $400, I believe, for early bird registration. The majority of people in 2008 and 2009 thought it was somewhat reasonable to not reasonable. That covers pretty much everybody. And nobody thought it was very reasonable. And as far as 2010 and 11, the question changed a bit as far as their expectations for this type. And over 50%, around 60%, 59.6 in 2010 and 65% in 2011 said that it was a lot higher than expected. And I guess $400 is pretty steep for a recent graduate to pay for that, but it is less than an average one credit course in graduate school for three more letters tacked on at the end of your name and improving the credibility of our profession. So I'd say that's a pretty good deal. And so the perceptions of the exam itself, the extent that the public health degree program prepared to take a person to take this exam, and the, let's see, about 60%, just under 60% of the respondents said that their degree program did prepare them to take this exam. And so, I mean, it shows it's pretty consistent across the years, so good job, item raters. And it doesn't seem to be a perceptible difference between the years that only alumni were taking it and the years that it was opened up to students. And so, as far as difficulty, the majority of responses also say that it was moderately difficult. Above 50% said it was moderately difficult. And nobody said that it was easy. So we should all study if you haven't taken it yet. And as far as how fair the examination was as a measure of required understanding, it does seem to kind of go around the middle where in 2008 and 2009, there was a much broader range of choices, but approximately a third in both years said that it was somewhat fair. About 20% thought it was neutral, it's about 20%, or well, 15 to 30% said that it was somewhat unfair. So somewhere around the middle where people think that it's a general understanding. Nobody thought it was very fair, and very few people thought it was very unfair. In 2010 and 11, over half, so 55% and 59%, about 60%, thought that it was somewhat fair measure of understanding. So kind of as take-home messages, examinees seem to have largely taken the exam to improve their credibility and the credibility of the profession, which is consistent with who we are as public health professionals. Salary isn't a primary motivation, so employers don't need to worry about having to increase salaries of their employees, and so therefore encouraging them to take the CPH exam would be a good step. And more examinees are being encouraged by their public health programs, such as my experience. And it looks like the exam is a fair compilation of all the public health competencies. So hopefully some of you will be joining me in February and taking the exam. It would be nice to know that I'm not the only one in the room there. And if anybody has any further questions for further information, contact the National Board of Public Health Examiners. Thank you.
So we have about 45 minutes for questions, so I'd like to open the floor up for any questions. Please.
I have a question, I guess, for Sama and for maybe more Donna. Does the NBPHG plan to open up the test to non-accredited schools? The reason that I ask is it seems a little bit, and I'm not meaning to offend anybody, but maybe elitist for only the accredited schools to be able to take the exam, because these people who might have graduated with an MPH from the unaccredited school
do it as an exercise, in essence, for ourselves as a quality insurance reviewer. And so that's kind of where it is. It's still young, and we're only in our fifth year. So it's not that that's not possible in the future, but right now the focus is still internally.
Donna, if I could just ask, and I don't know if this is hearsay or a fact, but in addition, because the accredited schools of public health took this on, the cost incurred by the schools is phenomenal. You wouldn't believe the cost, so I think that also, enormous cost that they took on in order to develop and now administer this, so. Yeah. Yes, please.
I just add, you know, there are programs that are in pre-accreditation mode. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that they're in the process of working toward getting accredited. And, you know, the problem is, CEEF won't even, it's the only institution that I know of that you have to graduate a class before you can go through accreditation. I'm a doctor, you know, this medical school has to be accredited before they even let anyone walk in the door. So if you have, you know, and that means you have 3 years, it takes about 3 years from the time you actually, you know, you have to graduate a class, so that's like 2 years. So you put in your application, there's another 3 years. So I mean, there's going to be a portion of your students who, by the fact that, you know, if you get accredited in 5 years, will not be eligible because it only goes back 3. And I don't know if there's any consideration of why they wouldn't consider that if the student went through the program and the program gets accredited, and they want to sit for the exam, why they couldn't. It's a different issue than the, you know, totally non-accredited, don't want to be accredited, et cetera, don't want to go through that process. But if your program, like mine, is going through the process, and we're penalized because the process takes about 5 years to go through, I think it's unfair because, you know, it takes 2 years to graduate the class, and then, you know, you have to apply and get your clock started. And I don't know why that wasn't considered, because at that point, the students would be from the accredited program. I mean, they couldn't sit until
the
program.
So the decision was made to allow for 3 years prior. And I honestly don't remember why we picked 3, but it's all a work in progress. So any of these things are possible discussion items. It's not like we won't discuss them.
How did that get proposed?
I've now heard it, so has Molly. That's why you come to these sessions.
Well, I have a question about what did you say about the 3-year rule? I'm just not aware
that if you are, so you're a student at Nebraska, just got accredited.
Okay.
So we didn't want to, but no one wanted to say, well, you know, only the students that graduate after they get their accreditation are eligible. Because certainly in the time that they're going through the accreditation process, they should be delivering a quality program. If they get accredited, they clearly were delivering a quality program. We, in our mind, said for at least 3 years prior to that. So we said if you graduated within 3 years of the accreditation, you would be eligible to sit for the exam. Mm-hmm. That was the logic at the time.
I guess in terms of logic, you would generate more revenue if you open it up to anybody that's in the workforce.
Yep.
That seems kind of arbitrary.
Well, again, they didn't want to be examined at the time. Those of us that have the battle scars from those days. and that attitude has changed, of course. You don't want something and then someone else has it and you want it. So, you know, all of that is under discussion.
I'm just wondering, I've been in public health since before your test, and we're right now at my university looking to start a master's program in public health and looking at a few different, you know, tests in terms of the accreditation and sort of in the future. And I've been around since CHEZ was kind of the test, and so I'm just wondering, how are you guys sort of competing with, well, and now CHEZ and the MCHEZ mm-hmm. that they've now put out? Are you finding, because of the non-accreditation school, that you're finding people going to CHEZ? Like, what have you done in terms of comparing your test to theirs, and like what students would choose to do?
Well, the woman next to you has both the CHEZ and CPH.
Okay.
That's her name. CHEZ is a specialty exam for health educators. There are mm-hmm. other certification exams. There's one in industrial hygiene. There's the idea that they want to help improve the credibility of the profession as well as their own credibility as professionals within that profession. So it's a voluntary thing.
Yeah. Well, and also in my case, I went to one of the early schools that had an undergraduate public health program, which I thought at the time was very valuable. However, what I found was when I went out to start looking for jobs, everyone kept saying to me, where are you getting this degree from? Because it was really more a master's level program at this, and this was in the 90s. So, and that was what they sort of pushed us towards, was just CHES, because obviously this didn't exist at the time. So I'm just kind of sitting here thinking, do I need to go back and do another certification? And would it make sense for me to, you know, in my own personal opinion, because this is so new compared to what we were encouraged to do in the past.
I can just add to that. I direct the MPH program in health promotion at the Mailman School of Public Health, which is within our social and behavioral science department. And I do have the CHES certificate, and I encourage all our graduates to do both.
I do.
Okay. And after speaking to them, they're glad that they do, because in terms of the CHES exam, it focuses much more specifically on the competencies under the core social and behavioral science departments. Just to add. Others, please.
Ask a different question on for why. I was curious in terms of your concept mapping that what you chose, at least what it appeared, is you're choosing to go for the feasible aspects versus one. I believe one of the main things was sort of a dean that would be more appropriate for the focus of the school.
Oh, that was just an example statement, but yeah.
But I was just wondering the difference between trying to do things prior to the leadership.
Right. No,
aspect
no.
And how that might interfere.
Right. Because
presently or in the future.
Right. Because leadership is obviously an important component in the rebuilding process. And what we tried to look at was which clusters and which items were both important and feasible. So school focus and comprehensive curriculum were rated, and those are the two areas that we think may be the first areas that we look at. Obviously, you know, leadership, faculty, support are important, but they may not be as feasible to implement in the next 5 years. So, you know, I mean, you know, this is just like an overview of what items we have to look at in terms of what order we look at that may be.
Now, is some of this in process at this time,
yes.
Or is this?
Yes, we're actually in process of rebuilding.
Cheryl? On admission, I have not taken the exam. I'm, you know, certainly eligible for it and scared to take it as somebody's been working on the job for like, you know, 30 years. But I'm just curious as to, because I saw like an early version of the exam. I have to admit, I just found it rather idiosyncratic.
How did you see a version of the exam?
I saw somebody who had signed up for it, I saw like over their shoulder kind of thing. So I saw questions from it.
You saw sample questions or study guide questions developed
by
the
AAPH. Yeah,
they were not
about
options.
Yeah, yeah. So that's just, okay, so it was just very some of the questions were just like very idiosyncratic. Like clearly it was like this person, and I'm sure you've improved your item writing process. Their view of what they thought was so important in their class to teach that, I mean, you know, nobody else would have to listen. But that's not, I just raised it as a contextual thing. So I'm just wondering, since it is sort of, it's a quantitative exam, and I haven't really seen it, if you could talk a little bit more about how it really does assess a person's understanding rather than just simply capture, you know, kind of like how well they know certain facts or are able, you know, the typical multiple choice exam, because that, to me, that's not the world of competency, as we all know. And so I'm not raising it as a challenge to me. I truly want to understand, in order to think about how to make this exam really something useful as somebody who teaches in public health program, to make it a useful educational experience, because that's my view of test taking. It should be an educational experience. Mm-hmm.
So you're absolutely right. The multiple choice format is a limiting format in terms of your ability to assess. That's absolutely true. We know that. The expenses involved in developing something that would go beyond that was not something we were able to bear at that time. We did they would tabulate it, we don't care if they do the item writing process. We assemble a group of 30 individuals from across the competency domains. They submit items. They are assigned items based on their expertise. Those items are sent to the NBME, who edits them. They've been writing multiple choice questions forever. They get sent back to the item writers, who then, you know, take those edits into account. And then we meet in person, and each item writer reads his or her items out loud to the group. The group critiques the item. They critique. Is the item clear? Is it fair? Is it understandable? And most importantly, is it something that would be taught in an introductory class? Because that's the level that we are looking for, a minimum competency at this level. It's an MP. It's like the USMLE Step 1, if you will. Minimum competency. The first time the exam was assembled, we did what's called a standard setting exercise. We brought in a group of people who had nothing to do with writing items on the exam, but who are experts, again, in these areas. They sat in cubicles and actually took the exam. They looked at each item. I'm sorry, we did this after the first administration. They looked at each item. We spent hours in the morning discussing what a minimally competent MPH graduate would look like, so we had that in our heads. Sat down, looked at each item, rated how difficult we thought it would be for that minimally competent person, and then they looked at the actual result on the item. And I can tell you, sitting in there, you could hear the gasps around there. That either they knew something they never thought they would know, or they didn't know something that they thought was patently obvious. Your point about testing minutia is a criticism we've heard before, but I think we try very hard to balance knowledge of critical sentinel events, which we do think people should know, with conceptual kinds of things. A lot of the items are, there's a scenario, you have to be able to analyze and understand the scenario and then answer a series of questions. We try very hard to make it as comprehensive an assessment of competency, minimal competency, as we can. That's the state of our ability at this point in time, but I think your points are very well taken.
Cheryl, just to add before this question, I was an item writer 2 years ago, and they're representing the social and behavioral science section of the test. There were at least four other people who had also written items, didn't know each other, from very different schools. It was an incredibly rigorous process. I have to give you a lot of credit. And we thrashed out all of these issues and very, very rigorous.
I would say, as someone who has taken the test as part of their charter class, that probably what you saw was the first edition of the ASPH study manual. That was a lot more idiosyncratic than the test. The test was not anything crazy. It was all very rational stuff that you would expect to know coming out of it.
Thank you. Please, and then please.
Do you have any plans to get some information because so many of the people who took the test wanted to take it because they thought it gave them more credibility in their field. Is that happening? I mean, is there any way to assess that other than, you know, anecdotal?
Yeah, with a couple thousand people, not yet. I think I'm from one of those schools that's had hundreds of students take students and alumni take the exam. I think I'm the only one who can say that. And in our community, it has become very, very evident. It is anecdotal. I haven't done full analysis of this, but I've had graduates call me and thank me for encouraging them to take this test because they absolutely believe they got a job that they wouldn't have gotten in this market right now. And when I talk to the county health directors in the region, they say, well, yeah, it's a no-brainer. I mean, the people that are, you know, closely equivalently qualified, one's got a CPH after their name. That tells me something, not only about their knowledge and skill, but about them as an individual. Voluntary test, they all understand that. The fact that you would take it despite all your anxiety and pass it says something to them. So I think, you know, as we put more out there, I think, again, I'm not to even undress like this, we think that we'll start seeing an elevation of the status.
Yeah, I took the first one and it's helped me a teaching job in college, so.
Yeah, that's our hope. This is a big country, and we've only, you know, a couple thousand people. But we admire many pioneers.
I think we had a question over here, and then you, sir.
Certificate program. I think one of the slides said an accredited certificate.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I was really impressed with this is regarding Georgia State on your certificate. I was impressed with kind of the depth you went and how extensive you did your assessment to launch a certificate. So, because I know sometimes certificates are just thrown together from a faculty discussion and the ideas popped and you try it out. So, could you talk a little bit about the economics of that in terms of what you're investing in it and also kind of.
You mean in terms of the preparation, the
assessment? Yeah, and then also what kind of expectations you have for enrollment. And, I mean, do you need, like in our organizations, to launch a certificate, or we need a business plan to guarantee a certain number of students per quarter, per semester?
You're right, and the person who's in charge of the business plan and the funding is not here with us today, but we did receive a grant from the NACDD to do the preparation, the research, the survey, to find out what was needed in the field first, and that they funded that for us. And we're hoping that we will be able to get, our plan is to get two individuals from each of the 50 states, the territories. So about 118 students in the first enrollment, and we're in the process of securing funds for that. And so our first cohort, we're hoping to be about 118 students nationwide.
Nationwide, yeah.
We are still working, we're in the working process of securing the implementation funds right now we had for the preparation.
I was sitting here thinking, sloppily, we've kind of put together and launched a few different projects or certificates without that kind of rigorous advanced preparation. So it's a wonderful model.
Please.
On the certificate question, can students in the degree program take those courses that are in the certificate, and do they count toward the degree?
We began saying that the emphasis was going to be on people already working in public health departments who couldn't come back into a residency type degree. It's sort of up in the air right now. We will probably still continue to emphasize its accessibility to people out in the field. That was one of the primary reasons we set it up as online. But ultimately, there may well be the option for folks who are actually, we've already had interest from folks in the school about taking online courses.
That will count towards their degree?
Yes.
In our experience.
The certificate program is going to be a 15 credit hour program, and the credits are supposed to go towards the MPH, and we've checked to make sure that they will be applied towards an MPH and other master's.
Any other questions? Well, thank you so much to everyone on the panel.